Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 153, is Andrew Horowitz. And yes, you are hearing some wonderful Zydeco music. And why are we playing that Zydeco music? Well, I'll be in New Orleans, having some fun. And you're listening to Queen Ida and the Bon Tom Zydeco Band. Isn't that fun? Love that music. I'll be down there doing all sorts of fun things. I have planned a tour of the Ninth Ward, which is, I don't know if you've been there before, but this is where the Hurricane Katrina hit directly on, and still to this day, it really hasn't been fixed. Nothing's been done. It's really looking pretty lousy. I'll let you know next week what that's all about. I'm also going to be visiting the World War II Museum, the D-Day Museum. Fun place to be. Not to mention all my favorite spots for dinner, Commander's Palace, Mother's. I'm going to go on to probably going to have some beignets over at Café du Monde. And, of course, the Oyster House. And, oh, boy, we're going to have a good time. I got to tell you, also doing some fishing for redfish. Now that you heard all about that, the fun that I'm having, now you understand why we're playing a little bit of that Zydeco music in the background. More importantly, how about these markets? What are we going to talk about there? Well, I thought what we'll do today, perfect for my trip down to New Orleans and all the fun and kind of things that I'll be getting into, we'll put it that way. I thought I'd bring on, I think this is perfect. He is the manager. This guy is the manager of a fund actually called, you're not going to believe this, but called the Vice Fund. The Vice Fund. And the gentleman that I'll be talking about today, he actually writes, besides that, he's also with Behind the Numbers. And what's interesting is that he really breaks down all of the, I guess we could say, all the things that are going inside the earnings forecast and releases and kind of behind the nitty-gritty. His name is Jeff Middlesworth, and we're going to have him on in a little bit to talk about all sorts of interesting things that I think you'll enjoy very much. In the meantime, let's talk about some of the things that are on the table. I want to thank everyone who has given and donated so graciously to the Jason Taylor Foundation, the Reading Initiative. I'm going to ask you, this is officially my birthday weekend. You know, if you haven't gotten that little update on Facebook that you're probably getting, I'd love to hear from you on the wall, a little something. Love to talk back and forth. I do that quite often, as much as possible. And, of course, on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. But if you haven't done so and kind of you think, well, other people are going to be doing it, and you know what? Nobody else is going to be helping out but you. You are the person that's going to be helping put some tuition for an at-risk child to go through a reading initiative program, a reading comprehension program to help them in school, keep them off the streets. And I would very, very, very much appreciate it. You can give anything, you know, $10, $20, $50, $100. Try to get anybody who gives a bit more than that, a little special something, a little signed autographed copy of my book, along with a copy of a picture of myself and Jason Taylor, the all-pro Miami Dolphins. And don't forget, he's also the Dances with Stars. I don't know what you thought of him there. Nice fellow. We're going to have him on the show very shortly to talk about the idea of finance and you know, pro ball. You know, what's it like in that range of the financial area, and what does he deal with on a daily basis? But in the meantime, I would very much appreciate, just please go to the show notes page, click on the donate button. This is going to be the last chance to do it. And I got to tell you something, it's for a really worthy cause. If we've ever given you a stock that you made money on, or to keep you away from the market, anything, please do it. And I'm pressing this really hard because it's very important to me. Push pause on the podcast and go donate to the Jason Taylor Foundation right now. And like I said, it will very much appreciated. And anybody that does give will get a special note from me as well. And of course, you know, my eternal thanks. All right, let's talk about who's coming on the show. Let's talk about what's going on in these markets. Let's talk about a little bit of the things that are happening that I think that are very interesting. Brazil. There's a recent commentary out on Brazil, and there was the idea that Brazil was going to have a rate increase because their inflation is starting to get a little bit out of hand. We saw that. Of course, in many countries already starting to think, hey, you know what, if we have these commodities that are doing so well and we've reinflated the economy. Commodity prices are coming up. We need to make sure that we don't step into an inflationary environment. Well, wouldn't you know it, they didn't do it. Which, again, tells you that maybe the economy is a little bit softer than we thought. Don't forget, Australia has about, I think they had 3 rate increases recently. And we had, don't forget, about our rate increase here, even though it was kind of a small, insignificant rate increase. It was the discount rate, not the Fed funds rate, which would affect most of us differently. But there was a recent write-up by JP Morgan that talks about the decision to postpone the hiking cycle increases inflation risk in Brazil. Just as a disclosure, we've taken half a position of Brazil off the table, so to speak. We had a beautiful profit twice, once on the nice run-up on Brazil, and nice recently we had another, I think, 15 or 16% in from the downstroke this year. Actually, we kind of entered back into it a little bit last year and a little bit this year again towards the end of the year. But now what's happening is that there is a revision that's coming for inflation projections on the upside, with current forecasts at about 5.1%. For 2010, 4.7 for 2011, and this could increase the risk of higher interest rates, along with the whole idea of a real tightening of the cycle. And this is a problem because most are considering this a lose-lose situation. So because what happens is the domestic sectors are losing ground in anticipation of a hiking cycle, and the short-term reaction of maintaining the rates are causing some problems. Anyway, the whole environment right now is a problem if you add into the fact that they are so highly leveraged to commodities and oil. If the dollar continues higher, and you know, we saw it kind of give back a little bit last week. Oil was at about 82.5. We blew our stops on our short oil position, which we will re-enter into when things calm down a little bit. But you know, the dollar has been a major problem for Brazil. Whenever the dollar strengthens, you will see Brazil sell off, because not only are they hurt by the dollar, they're double hurt by the fact that the oil is hurt by the dollar. Traditionally, you'll see that many countries will be, emerging market countries will be hurt if the dollar actually moves up, but none so much and inflicting such pain as you see when, you know, in Brazil as an example, because there's a double whammy there. So that's the Brazil situation. Take a look at that. EWZ is the ETF we use there. There's also a lot of talk out of China lately. Have you heard this? We talked about this briefly on DH Unplugged the other night, and I talked with John Dvorak about the whole idea of, you know, what's going on with the whole, you know, are they going to raise the rates? Are they going to continue to hold down the value and peg the value of yuan or the renminbi, whatever you want to call it? And their currency is right now very out of whack. Why is their currency out of whack? Essentially, it's out of whack because their economy is so much stronger than ours is, and they've held their currency in peg with the U.S. Very smart of theirs. About 30 or 40 or 50 different senators and congressmen have written recently a letter that said that China is a currency manipulator. If you remember back about a year and a half ago when Tim Geithner came in, he said, and then backtracked, of course, in his little weaselly way, he backtracked and said, he first said that China is a currency manipulator. They are manipulating the currency, pegging it to the dollar, and you know what? That's a problem. Of course, he later said, oh, I didn't really say that. That's not what I meant. Because there was a lot of a downdraft on that. You know, you had China breathing down our necks saying, hey, you mess with us, you know what? Maybe we'll stop buying your treasuries, which you need to fund your disgusting bailout of the banks at the level of trillions of dollars that you need from us. So why don't you do yourself a favor? Stop calling us currency manipulators. Stop giving us a problem. We'll go do what we need to do to make our country strong, our economy strong. And you do what you need to do. Stop name calling, stop pointing fingers, and kind of do yourself a favor and make your own house much stronger. We'll deal with what we have to deal with. Well, here we are about a year later, and once again, there's a lot of finger pointing going on. These senators, these congressmen, I don't know what's on their minds. I honestly, I've kind of gotten to a point, I've stopped even considering it because they're so they're out of control. I mean, I talked to Frank Kurzier today, and I'm like, Frank, what is the deal? I mean, is it like we've all gone insane here? And he says, you know what? You just got to consider what's going on, the politics of what's going on. Everybody is in the same boat. Nobody really can understand what's going on with these guys. What they say is not what they do. What they do is not what they say. And the bottom line there is that, you know, you have to consider the fact that, you know, they're out of control. So we're looking at this now. We're finding that China has actually started to conduct stress tests. So I put on the website another piece that we got. This was also out of JP Morgan. And they made a list of companies that would do very well in the event that China started to raise their their currency, you know, to allow their currency to float. Why? Well, they'll have a lot more buying power. If they raise the value of their currency, while it would hurt their overall exports, it would really help their imports. Well, who would that help? So we put a list on the website right above the Jason Taylor donation form, wink, wink. and I think that that's something to really consider. I don't know if China really is in the position, other than to be discussing and creating a, just a whole lot of rhetoric involved in this whole situation. But, you know, as we've seen everybody else do, you know, the finger pointing and the fact that China is not buying the amount of treasuries. We put that on their site last week. We called it the tick data came out this week. And it's clear China is just not buying the way they used to. All right. So one other thing, the Standard & Poor's rating service raised the rating on India. Now, I was shocked about this, because I was thinking about, as I was reading this, I couldn't believe that India is now rated the same, or has been rated the same, as Greece. And don't get me started on Greece. I must tell you, talk about the biggest bag of wind that has ever been created on this earth is this whole, I can't use the word because we're a clean show, but let's just say it is the garbage that is coming out of the EU. Every day we're hearing another story. We're hearing political bantering that is absolutely untrue, that they turn on a dime. Greece is trying to make a case that they're strong and that they'll reduce their debt ratios down to the deficit down to 3% in, what is it, a year and a half or something like that, when they're currently at 12. Impossible, guys. Hello. It's not going to happen. You could put any austerity plan that you want on the table. It is not going to happen. If it would have happened, you would have done it already. But the only reason why you're doing it now and trying to make this plan is because you need another $5 to $10 billion for short-term financing of debt that's rolling over. And don't tell us anything other. When we see that the EU is backing off and saying, you know what, you guys should talk to the IMF. We do not have the capacity to handle your situation. We know there's a problem. The euro was climbing and doing well right after everybody said, oh, everything's fine, after they were reaffirmed by, I believe it was S&P last week. You know what? Reaffirm all you want. We know that there is no way that you're going to get the situation, particularly in a country like Greece, where a country where the workers are retiring at such an early age, have so many benefits, they're not just going to give up on it so easily, folks. Not happening. I digress. Point was that I was trying to make was that the India outlook was raised by the Standard & Poor's. And that's great. Actually, what we're considering doing is we took half the position of Brazil off the table for our clients, and we're potentially moving it and increasing our India exposure. We like the big companies, BIC, the Brazil, India, and of course, China and Hong Kong. China, you can look at both sides. We prefer Hong Kong right now. So those are a couple of things that are going on right there. Lots more to talk about with our guest that's coming up. I also mentioned that the FOMC statements came out this week. It is the text of the meeting. And what do we see? We saw that the Fed is committed to staying with a very low interest rate environment until they say otherwise, of course. But they say in their notes for an exceptionally long period of time. Federal Reserve Chief Chairman Honig was the dissenting. He's done this before. He was dissenting in this. And he believed that the economy and fiscal conditions had really changed sufficiently that the expectations of exceptionally low levels of federal funds rate for an extended period of time was no longer warranted. Well, that's nice to hear. Why aren't they doing it? Do they care about inflation? They don't care about inflation. If you look at the PPI number that came out and the CPI number come out, there is no inflation here. You know why there's no inflation? Because demand still stinks. Most of the earnings that are benefiting and most of the things that are happening with corporate America are still because of cost cutting to the bone. And that's going to be very helpful for a time we need the consumer to come back. We're still seeing over 450,000 print of initial claims on a regular basis, on a weekly basis. That is not slowing up. We see continuing claims staying as high as they are. That is not slowing up. I can't wait till the day comes that this market, that this economy will be able to come off life support and this government will just step aside for 5 seconds and let this heal. But you know what? This administration won't, and that's why we're all pretty disgusted with them. Because, you know, you're using these tactics that are propping and pumping and pushing, but they're not letting the patient kind of walk on their own. And that's very sad in our opinion. But we'll see. It'll happen eventually. It always does. Let's see. One last thing here. I got this. Mark Faber told CNBC that U.S. Treasury yields, listen to this, in 5 to 10 years, the 10-year U.S. Treasury could yield 10 to 20%. I mean, you could drive a Mack truck right through that range. But, you know, Mark Faber, who from the gloom, doom, and boom report, is more of the gloom and doom side of things, of course. Google is all having all sorts of problems there. I think it's really interesting what's going to play out. What do you think about that? I mean, is Google going to kind of walk out and be done with it? Or is, I don't know. It seems like that would be a very big problem for them to do so, especially that they want to start selling their phone there. We'll see. And, boy, I have lots more to talk about. I have a whole list of things, but we're going to have to move on here so we don't run into hours and hours of this particular show. By the way, if you do want to become a client, if you are kind of saying, all right, I want in on this market, I want to get, be able to trade and do what I want to learn, if you want to do so, check out our tour, 14-minute virtual tour of the Disciplined Investment Management Strategy. And basically what we do is with $50,000 minimum, for this strategy, $500,000 minimum for our other strategies, what we can do is you'll be part of the trading portfolio, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, and basically you'll be able to get our information because we're fully transparent. We show you what's going on. And I got to tell you something, folks, if you haven't taken advantage of this, you know what? This, if you like the things that we've talked about and the things, the concepts, not all the winners, not all the losers, but if you like the concepts and how we do things, maybe it's time for you to consider that. There's a commercial for the day. Aside from Jason Taylor, go check that out. I would love to work with you, and I'd love to talk to you personally, and you be a part of the whole Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy family and the Horowitz and Company family. That would really be great. Anyway, we're gonna hook up. We're going to get that phone call kind of plugged in, and we do. We're going to be back with a gentleman who is going to educate us about the vice fund, investing in bad things, cigarettes, tobacco, gambling. He's going to tell us about, you know, how actually we can do things that maybe and make money on things that aren't so good for us. His name is Jeff Middlesworth, and we're going to be right back with him. So stick around. This is episode number 153, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, as I promised, we have, I think, a pretty interesting segue from my trip to New Orleans and all the things you can get in trouble doing down there to the manager of the Vice Fund. Yes, that's the VICE Fund. All the bad things that are out there, the things you're not supposed to think about, do, or invest in. We have Jeff Middlesworth, and he's going to be talking to us about that. He also writes a nice newsletter called Behind the Numbers, which read, and I find it to be very interesting. And Jeff, how about we talk about some of the things that are going on and some of the head-scratching things that are happening, behind the whole market right now. What do you say?
Sure. To me, a couple of the big trends that you really see out there, one, what should be the big red flag that no one's really focusing on is how many companies have no top-line growth.
Right.
Sales are flat. Volume is down in some cases. They don't have pricing power, and you're seeing warnings of that from a number of companies. A lot of the restaurants, a lot of the food companies are all reporting that they just don't have any pricing power anymore. And that's an indication that people are still trying to trade down. They're not spending as much money as everybody hoped the recovery would be. But the flip side of that is that these companies are beating estimates. And so with no top-line growth, it has to be coming from a combination of either they expect nothing from them. I've seen companies that are being touted as the next big growth vehicle that's growing at 5-7% because everybody only assumed it would grow at 4. So very meager forecast to a large degree. But the biggest part of the cost savings is coming from lower commodity prices. And that's kind of a two-year process where everyone remembers 2008, oil at 140 and corn was $7 and things of that nature. Well, from the fourth quarter of 2008 pretty much until the summer of 2009, you had commodities just in collapse. And so a lot of these companies had a year-over-year cost comparison on commodities that was a huge tailwind. Commodities have been rising sequentially pretty much since the summer of 2009, and so a lot of these companies are now seeing higher year-over-year costs for first quarter, second quarter of 2010. Fourth quarter 2009 was basically their last easy tailwind quarter, And so the fact is that, you know, you have no top-line growth, you have a big decrease in your cost structure, and now you're seeing costs go up and you're seeing a lack of pricing power. So a lot of these companies that saw some earnings gains, saw some margin improvement, a lot of that's going to reverse simply due to cost.
So let me ask you this. This is fascinating because I think the poster child for this discussion we're having right now in the food industry was Chipotle, which I always say that wrong. It's Chipotle. How do you say that? You know?
I go with Chipotle.
Yeah, Chipotle. All right. All right. Yeah. So Chipotle, or whatever it's called. Anyway, this is great. I love the place, by the way. But, you know, if you think about what's on their menu for a second, they were the poster child for getting squashed when at the height of the commodity pricing. Why? They used a ton of corn. They had all sorts of vegetables. You know, the bean prices that they had there, too, was moving up. You know, think about the corn chips, the corn, you know, their tortillas. They had corn in the corn. They had the chicken prices. They had the beef prices. I mean, they were the poster. Am I wrong? I mean, they were the poster child for what could go wrong, right?
Yeah, that's very true. You know, chicken has certainly gone up. Almost all the meats, beef, chicken, pork, you know, have gone up because people in 2008 slaughtered all the herds. And, you know, they were trying to correct their own pricing and their own supply-demand imbalance. And so now you're in a situation where a lot of those prices are still rising again.
But isn't this time different? I don't mean to say that because that sounds awful. But
sure.
The difference is they know this and they're more prepared. They saw what happened last time, whereas in the past they were kind of like, la-di-da, things are going to be fine forever. I mean, didn't they get the crap scared out of them?
Well, you've got some companies that are trying to hedge those type of costs. You know, the problem is always that you can't hedge forever.
Right.
You might be able to help yourself for a quarter or two, but it's not like you're going to lock in all of your corn purchasing through the year, you know, 2018.
Right.
You can only hedge out so long. The other issue you've got with a lot of these companies is they're all trying to tout how much cash flow they're generating. And the way they're generating cash flow is they're taking down their inventory numbers. And so you see the poster child for this, for me, is Starbucks. Starbucks is a company that has every aspect of what they're selling. Sugar is just going through the roof. Dairy prices. Dairy fell at the end of 2008 by 50%.
Mm-hmm.
It's been rising sequentially ever since. They've beaten their numbers two or three quarters in a row, and it was all due to lower dairy prices on a year-over-year basis. That tailwind is gone now, and you can't really hedge dairy because it's a perishable product.
Right.
But because they were so tied up, and we want to show Wall Street that we can lower our inventories and produce cash flow. This is a company that normally stocks, 10 to 15% of their sales in coffee inventory. You know, they're at 9. And coffee's been going up.
Coffee's been going up dramatically. Coffee's been going up dramatically. Sugar is off the hook.
Well, and tea has gone up in the last year or two for the first time in over a decade. There were droughts, in Central America and Asia that affected coffee and tea prices for the first, for a while. And so you're seeing input prices for them go up. In some cases, they're doubling. And they didn't stock up on anything. At the same point, you know, they have McDonald's rolling out new coffee. Dunkin' Donuts has gotten coffee. You've got
Burger King. Burger King. Let's not
Burger
forget about.
King.
Wait. Yeah. Burger King is going to be Starbucks.
Hmm?
Burger King is going to be Starbucks. Did you see that?
I've seen some of that, but the issue is that it's going to be at a lower price.
Right. And so they're going to compete against themselves.
Yeah. Well, it's going to keep taking the pricing down. It's going to be a situation of. You can work. You can go to the traditional Starbucks and get something for $4, or you can go to Burger King and get it for $1.50.
Or you can buy yourself one of those K-Cup machines through Green Mountain. I don't know what happened to our culture lately, but we are freaks about coffee, aren't we?
Well, what we found is that people are drinking as much coffee as they always did,
mm-hmm.
But we found studies that show people are spending about 40% less, which
really?
Means they're drinking it at home and brewing it themselves, or they're getting it at work.
Right.
You just don't have as many people that... would stop at Starbucks on the way to the office and buy coffee, or if they go to McDonald's, they're buying it at a lower price than Starbucks. So if Starbucks faces these growing costs and they didn't stock up on inventory, you've got pricing pressure as people don't want to pay as much, and you've got more outlets to buy all this stuff.
Meanwhile, it hit a 52-week high recently, right? and it's kind of cruising along the merry way. Everybody loves it. Analysts are all over this thing. I don't even think I've seen anybody say there's anything bad about Starbucks. What are we to make of
this? That's very true.
Seriously, what are we making of this?
To me, the upgrade that came yesterday or day before, to me, was a lot of just fantasy. It was essentially, hey, we didn't like the stock. We didn't like it at 19. Then they liked it again at 21, 22, something like that. As the stock rose another point, they just said, oh, well, now we'll raise our target to 30.
Right.
And that was the rationale was essentially it hit the target we had before, so let's just raise the target higher.
Right.
There's a lot of fantasy stuff going on there, and it's not sustainable. One other tidbit with Starbucks that's interesting is they closed a lot of stores last year.
Right.
And if you think about it, I mean, everyone's aware that where there's a Starbucks, there's always 10 more within a mile. if you close one store, two stores in that little area,
right.
they don't lose those sales. Those sales just go to the remaining open stores.
Right.
And so you should have seen a big jump in same-store sales simply by having the closed stores, which were the laggard ones anyways, taken out of the matrix, and then having those sales captured at the remaining stores.
Right.
They reported a zero on customer growth in the last quarter, which was shocking to us. I mean,
wait, customer growth per store, you mean? Not customer growth. Customer growth per store or customer growth? Because it wouldn't change, would it?
Their same-store sales number was a 4% growth.
Mm-hmm.
2% of that came from pricing, and 2% came from the via... you make it yourself.
Oh, that by the way, don't even start me on that. That just totally that totally brought down the name, in my opinion. It totally made it, you know, it's supposed to be a high-end thing, and all of a sudden you're throwing out instant coffee. I mean, come on. Folgers is next.
Oh, I totally agree. But, you know, that was what we consider an apples to oranges comparison, because you're looking at it in 1 year when you have a product, the year before you didn't have it. So that was 2%. Pricing was 2%. Transactions were zero. And given that you should have had these remaining stores should have captured the lost sales from the stores that were closed, you should have had a big bump there, and they didn't, which tells me that McDonald's has taken a lot of share from them.
Yeah, I would agree. So let's talk about what this is. So you have this thing called Behind the Numbers, which is a newsletter that you write, and we'll put a link, of course. It's just behindthenumbers.com. We'll put a link here. But this is a very simple watch list we're talking about now, which is a culmination of all the different ideas you have, obviously. And I'm going to read these down straight. There's the most recent one that's out. Short-term warnings, which are companies that you've identified catalysts for underperformance within the next four quarters. Now, let me just start with that and tell you where I have a problem.
Okay.
Put you on the defense, sorry. you son of a gun. No. So the problem oftentimes is what I have found is that, you know, we pussyfoot around with the idea that, okay, these are going to underperform what? Well, underperform means market, I assume, or underperform something. And if the market goes up, let's say 10%, these may go up 7%. Well, they still go up. Are your short-term warnings or your long-term warning list anything like shortable conditions, or are these just like, you know what, you're just not finding the oomph in it?
Now, we're looking for absolute return short ideas.
Okay.
And, you know, relative value is second place for us as well. I mean, you can't eat relative returns.
Right. No, I agree.
So, yeah, we're trying to make money in absolute terms. You know, we're looking for companies that are in decline, companies that have accounting gimmickry going on, that where we expect to see charge-offs, or, you know, where reality is going to have to be forced on into this situation, and the company will have to come clean and announce a lot of bad news. So what we're looking at is we're not trying to find what I consider to be a good company that's going to have a one-quarter hiccup. Let's say a company that was... Everyone expected to grow at 15%, and it grew it only grew at 14%. You know, that's still pretty healthy.
Right.
We're looking for the company that is seeing negative growth, the company that has new competitors that are coming online, the company that kind of juiced a lot of its results for a couple of quarters, and that's going to reverse on them, and they'll have to pay the piper. And as a result, normally what happens is when they juice the numbers, people take up their expectations, and so it sets it up for a much bigger fall.
So, when they're taking up expectations, so you're here saying, here's what always troubles me, And this is not necessarily pointed at you, but the concept, right? So you're going through this, and let's say that you believe that Starbucks has some problems. You identify all these different things. And obviously, it's an opinion from what you can see, and you have to do projections, and you have to make assessments. And okay, so that's fine. But we're talking about there's also some reality in there about sugar pricing and coffee pricing, and maybe we'll even leave out customer trends because that could be questionable, right? And then there's another guy on the other side saying, oh, look at Starbucks. They are really poised for blah, 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 blah. And they're looking at the same data. Now, what happens there? Where is that disconnect? Seriously.
It comes from two places. One is just the guy who's bullish may completely agree with what we're saying.
And own shares. And own shares. But let's just, right?
Well, no, it's not that devious. Usually what will happen is he'll say, well, I think your problem is going to happen in, let's say, April. Or May, and we think there's enough positives for the rest of March that that we're willing to play it through March, and then we'll sell it, and then we agree with you. So you get a kind of a timing disconnect. Other times, people kind of get bogged down in some minutia. I've had debates with people who are bullish on names, you know, here and there, where. You know, I can basically point out how 90% of the company is in trouble, and you know, I'll agree with them. Hey, they've got a great business in, oh, let's say Argentina, and they will focus just on the Argentina operation and tell me how great it is and how it's really going, it's really growing, and it's going to double in size, and you know, and a lot of times, and they'll base their buy recommendation on that, and I'll look at it and say I completely agree with you there, but if 10% of the company doubles, then 90% of it gets cut in half. You know, this company's got more problems than positives. So that's usually the other disconnect that we have.
Okay, so let's talk about. Let's just put your money where your mouth is on this situation. And really, I go both ways, so to speak, buddy.
good thing it's radio.
Yeah, exactly. Starbucks Corporation. You are saying that's a short now. And what's your time frame?
I think it's a short. I've been saying it's a short since about 22, so I really like it here at 25. And my time frame is basically now. Results will be out in mid to late April for the first quarter, and I expect to see some of the commodity headwinds reverse on them. And then obviously I think they'll have to give lower guidance for the June period. A lot of that to me is based on the cost cutting that everybody points to of, oh, they closed laggard stores or they laid off employees, they reduced advertising, that type of thing. A lot of that really started in the fall of 2008, mm-hmm. So we're well past a lot of that as far as it being a period of a year later when you've got the lower cost structure versus the higher cost structure. You're now lapping a lot of those changes where you're going to have a lower cost structure for both periods.
Right.
And so you won't see the improvement in earnings as a result of that. And and the commodity stuff, the biggest tailwind they had working for them was lower dairy year over year. Dairy's now about 20-25% higher year over year.
Right.
And that they just can't overcome that.
So, you know, it's interesting because, and I want to spend time on one stock and one name only to kind of flush out the kind of things that you look at. Any of this could be interchangeable, but I want to mention something that just a couple of days ago I saw, and I believe it was, I'm trying to think of what it was. Was it General Mills? No, it wasn't General Mills. There was there's two different things. I think it was General Mills came out with a statement about, maybe it was Kraft. Anyway, that they're going to be reducing, this is so beautiful, they're reducing the sugar content in many of their products that are aimed at young children and people of all ages because they're trying to be more health conscious.
Well,
I can't stop them.
They'll do whatever they can. Yeah, whatever sells is what they want to do.
Right. So and then yesterday we saw somebody come out with a salt content, or the day before, that they're cutting down the salt content in many of their food items. And I honestly got a laugh out of it. Trying to make it look like and couch it and make it look like there is, you know, this beautiful benefit for my health when they're going to save 10 million pounds of salt a year, which I don't know how much salt costs a pound for them, but let's say a dollar. I don't know. You know?
Sure. Yeah. And for them, it's a cost-cutting move, and they'll spin it as positive.
It's such BS.
The old standby used to be the Hershey bar, you know, for a nickel or for a dime, and they just kept shrinking the size of the Hershey bar. So they said, "Well, we're not raising price."
Right.
But, Coke was the same way. The going from 12-ounce bottles and cans to 16 ounces,
right?
And say, well, we didn't increase the price per can, or it's, but at the same point, you're getting a third more,
right?
So it became an issue of, hey, you're pricing, you have pricing pressure, and their view is, no, it's the same price, and it's like, for a bottle, well, the bottle's bigger. Right.
So let me just go down this list. So these are the kind of reports that you write. I'm just going to buzz through this list. I'm going to pick a couple that I want to focus on. Colgate, under the short-term warnings, Colgate, Palmolive, Dick's Sporting Goods, First Solar, Marriott, Signet Jewelers, Starbucks, Tetra Tech, Tiffany, Vulcan Materials, Weingarten Realty Investors, and Whirlpool. On the long-term side, these companies may face eroding. This is not so much short now, but this is something to kind of keep in mind, I assume, right?
Those tend to be companies that will erode over several years.
Right, okay. So we have Amazon, AutoZone. By the way, AutoZone should have eroded by now, in my opinion. It's not eroding. I've looked at this. I've tried it. We made some money a couple of times on shorting it. It defies gravity, that company.
That one has a kind of a political bent to it. It's owned by a hedge fund manager named Eddie Lampert, and he also owns Sears and AutoNation, big chunks of them. And so the view is always that he's always very shareholder friendly in terms of buying back shares and that type of thing. And so that's what drives these stocks. And a lot of people expect there to be some sort of corporate merger between Sears and AutoZone,
That wouldn't be bad, actually. Although I'm not sure where that actually benefits either one of them, because one of them would have to.
It would hang them.
Sears would have to lose their whole automotive department. Is what would happen, essentially, because you can't merge it. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. I take that back. Avery Dennison, Dr. Pepper Snapple, Kraft Foods, McCormick and Company. McCormick Company is McCormick and Schmitz, right? I'm sorry.
That's a restaurant. McCormick is the spice company.
Spices, yeah. Macabre Libre, which pepper. I want to talk to you about, Salesforce, Sara Lee, Simon Property, Starwood Hotels, SVB Financial, and World Fuel. And these are just a list currently. Two I want to focus on. Whirlpool. I could focus on all these, actually. But, okay, Whirlpool. So Whirlpool Corporation, you would think that there is a problem there, that when you have a very deep recession, probably most people aren't going out and just saying, you know, let's, for the hell of it, let's get a new washer and dryer. Let's get a new refrigerator. I was in Best Buy last night. This is nothing scientific here. I'm just telling you. It looked like they were closing up the appliance division. Now, they may be. I don't know. But there was like...
Everyone's cutting back on it because it takes up so much floor space. And you just don't sell that much. You just don't sell very many of them.
So, but Whirlpool Corporation, are they going to benefit from this cash for client appliances crapola that went on recently?
We don't think so. There's a couple issues here. One is when you think of it for the cash for clunkers in the car division, you were taking people out of expensive cars to get them to buy a cheaper car. You know, they were going to sell a $40,000 Yukon. And in order to get the credit, you had to improve your gas mileage. So they were trading down to a Honda Civic, let's say, that maybe cost $20,000. So it lowered their cash outlay per month if they had a payment or something along those lines, and they got higher fuel efficiency and everything else. In appliances, they have to do the same thing. You have to buy an energy efficient appliance. Well, you can go buy a washer or dryer for $300, or you can buy the super green one for $1,200, so you have to spend a lot more money to be green and be politically correct in order to get the tax credit, and the tax credit's worth $80. So it doesn't work out on a cash flow situation. You're spending a lot more money to get a very small amount back. So in my mind, that's not a very intriguing incentive for people to really take advantage of.
Right.
The other problem that Whirlpool has. And this is kind of one of the basic parts of our short case. You know, they went through the housing boom with essentially only two other players. You know, it was Whirlpool, you had Electrolux in Europe, and you had Maytag. You had some other, smaller people that did it on an ancillary basis, but those were the main three. Well, they bought Maytag, and they've essentially liquidated it. So you had, lots of pricing power, you had lots of demand as home ownership went from 65%, which is where it had been for 30 years.
Right, because it was also built into the price of the house, don't forget. So when you bought a house, especially a new house, it was just one of those line items, and you didn't check what the cost is, and the absolute pricing power of the company to pretty much embed some ridiculous number of pricing on it was a whole different animal than actually you going out to replace the product, right? Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And, yes, it was the higher built, because you had a lot of built-in refrigerators.
Right,
you had,
right.
The stove is built in.
Right.
So, yeah, you definitely had that impact going on. But, you know, going forward, 2007, you had LG and Samsung jump into the market. And Whirlpool did, I mean, it looked exactly like the car market, so you pull that analogy out again, where, you know, when the imported cars came in, they went after the low end of the market. And then Ford and GM and everybody hid out in the high end in the big SUVs because nobody in Japan had a full-size truck. And so they were making $7,000 a unit selling a full-size SUV, and they were losing $300 a unit selling a car. Well, slowly the Japanese and the Germans marched up the chain into the higher-end stuff. But it took about 10 or 15 years for them to really get that going. In appliances, LG and Samsung went high-end within about 18 months, and they're taking share now. So now you've got a situation where you've got a much smaller market because people aren't buying homes, obviously. You have a shadow inventory that's out there of people that are defaulting on their homes and are taking the appliances with them that as they move in with their parents or they move into an apartment that already has appliances. You know, they're going to sell those appliances at a garage sale or Craigslist. So you have a big shadow inventory of very new machines out there, and you're splitting the market up amongst five people instead of two.
Right.
So all that to me adds up that Whirlpool's going to have a real hard time making all-time record earnings, which the street expects, basically this year and next year.
I mean, doesn't it sound just intuitively silly that during this time they're going to have an all-time records of earnings? Isn't there just something wrong with that concept just on the face of it?
I believe so. In this case, you've got the bulls again touting, cost cutting, which lower steel, lower resin prices help them. Those are both headwinds now. They've already admitted that that's going to be a $300 million increase in just raw material costs for them in 2010. And then you've also got people that say, well, at some point housing will get better, and therefore this is a stock. This is an early cyclical that you want to buy ahead of that. And while I agree with that logic, I don't know that it's this year, or
right.
I don't know that it's even next year,
right.
Especially as they have to work through all this demand. And then I seldom see anybody really mention the problems with just having a lot more competitors in the market. And with LG and Samsung, you've got companies that don't rely solely on appliances. I mean, they have cell phones and they have other electronic sales where they can lose money in appliances while they build market share, and then suddenly, you look up 3 years later, and they dominate the space.
Right,
and I think that's kind of where we're headed.
Hmm. All right, so let's. I want to move right over to one of your longer term. I'm still scratching my head on the whole Tiffany thing, by the way. I understand primarily Tiffany is being bought since we have a weaker dollar here, or we had a weaker dollar here, that a lot of foreigners are with other currencies, did a good job. I mean, Tiffany is almost at a 50. Forget 52 week. It's definitely at a 52 week. It's almost at an all time high.
Yeah,
I mean, the all-time high was somewhere about, 55, give or take? It's at 47 right now. I mean, mm-hmm. it's almost, we can go down this list and see similar situations. But Vulcan Materials, of being a concrete company, which we liked for a while during the recovery, but Whirlpool we talk about. So what about now, which something that I like, but yet we've actually done very well in the long. We tried to re-enter it once, and then we got our head smashed when... we had a little occurrence with a little bit of a devaluation. Actually, we entered post. Mercado Libre, which is the, well, I guess for the best way to describe it, is the Latin America eBay, essentially.
Yeah.
I find it to be a very interesting company, run very well, at least from what we can see. The problems that I see in this company, and tell me what you think, the most recent, well, first of all, there's a lot of little things that are going on, and not to mention the economy, but let's put that aside for a second, okay? But the mm-hmm. most recent devaluation by Venezuela, they had a big chunk of their stuff. Their business came from Venezuela, and I think they had taken down about 4 or 6 cents per share on the devaluation. Because if you were in Venezuela now, the business that you're doing is basically by half. In other words, the money's not worth as much.
Right, so, definitely true.
So that's a big problem. But what other headwinds do you see for this company? Because generally speaking, this looks like an interesting growth play.
For me, one of the big things is. this was a company that was growing a lot by just opening new markets, where it would come along and say, okay, 2005, we're in Mexico and Brazil, and then 2006, now we're in Chile as well. And so you'd get this big growth phase of adding a new large country to the mix, and that's where a lot of the growth was coming from. They've already rolled out in every country in Latin America, so there's not a lot of incremental growth if they want to pick up Belize, or something as their one last.
Oh, yeah, that's going to do a lot for them.
Yeah.
Have you been to Belize, by the way? Have you been there?
I've been there once, yeah.
Yeah, you going back?
I think it has 45,000 people in it.
Yeah, 45,000 people, and honestly, it is not – you would rather be, in my opinion – I'm sorry for Belize for saying this. You'd much rather be underwater there than above water.
Oh, it's 100 degrees and 100% humidity.
Well, not to mention the diving is much better than you know anything else. But Meli, we call it Meli. Meli is took a gigantic move down when we saw the devaluation. It went from about 50 down to about 40 in a matter of just kept going, and all of a sudden, you know, because of course the markets all move together. You can't have a stock go down if the markets are going up these days, right? This is one giant pile and one big party. Doesn't matter how sure. good or bad it is. Meli goes back up from 40 to about 47 recently. You know, it does, and still down, you know, for the year. But nonetheless, you know, do you think the short-term catalysts are there, or this is just blown out and done?
I think it's for the valuation it has and the rate that the growth is slowing, we think it's still got a long way to go. You still have a risk of having problems with Argentina for currencies, kind of like Venezuela. That might be longer. That might take a year or more, but they're certainly building the case for it. The other problem there is that a lot of their really high growth areas are lower margin. So they're doing stuff like free classified advertising, which is, you know, gone gangbusters, but it doesn't make any money for them. It just has a cost.
Well, Google doesn't make any money on anything either.
Well, and that's
right?
Very true.
Right?
They make money on their search engine, and that's about it. Right. Everything else they've ever tried, they've lost money at.
Yeah.
But Mercado Libre, you've also got the PayGo system that is lower margin. That's growing a little faster than their other sales.
That's like their PayPal.
Yes, right? Very much. Mm-hmm. And the other problem you've got with some of their stuff is that where's I going on this one? Oh, there's a lot of like really high sellers, like high volume sellers there, where you know, you might have like four guys that sell 20% of the cell phones in Brazil through Meli, and they had about 10 guys that was. That were arrested for tax evasion, for sales tax evasion,
oh
and that
boy.
Kind of stuff.
That's where it starts.
This was around Christmas time or New Year's, as I recall. And so it's a situation that you've seen a little bit of smoke there. It's not all the way done, but that's another spot where you could see greater problems.
Right.
And as these guys go to jail, you know, there goes a big chunk of your growth as well.
Yeah. Unless they have internet in the jail. Let's see. They can't. Don't rule that out.
That's very true.
You know?
The other thing with Meli that we don't like is the bulk of what they say. It's almost a cross between an eBay and Amazon.
Obviously
they do the garage sale stuff, but they also sell a lot of new products.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest sellers are stuff like cell phones, iPods, that type of thing. Well, the price of a lot of this stuff has a constant deflation to it.
Mm-hmm.
As electronics. So you're going to see a situation where they need to do more and more volume to do the same revenues, just because of price deflation and a lot of the tech stuff.
Right. So when it comes to, for example, looking at the earnings, looking at the general trends of these companies, I mean, you're obviously trying to dig into what's going on there. Salesforce is an interesting situation, which, you know, should be doing well from a CRM standpoint in the cloud. Companies are looking to get away from doing business internally. You know, they don't like these clunky systems where they're required to have an administrator, an IT staff or individual to go to, cost money, versus, you know, doing a Salesforce where they can either get a package plan or a one-off or a small business plan. But Salesforce at the same time would seem to have it reached a bit of a critical mass here, or getting close to it, and I think this is probably your thesis, but maybe I'm totally wrong here, that, you know, eventually they're going to see pricing pressure as well as companies are getting more and more used to it. At the same time, they've kind of gotten to the point, their apex, if you will, of the excitement of what they can do and how much more can they afford, especially if, you know, they have a lot of, we have a lot of different cloud competitors. Is that a, am I anywhere in the genre of, in the zone of what you're talking about?
Yeah, there's a lot of that in there. We were initially attracted to CRM for a couple reasons. And the first one was that it already had hit $1 billion in sales, which is sort of a, the bellwether mark for a software company where you start to see that operating leverage and you know, fixed costs stay the same and suddenly you're running more revenue through the model. They weren't seeing any margin expansion. And so that was kind of a red flag for us. And the next thing was we noticed how much, how many of their costs they capitalized, which essentially is a way to inflate earnings even though the cash flow is going out the door to pay for this stuff. So sales commissions, software was capitalized and would be amortized, R&D, that type of thing. And
so it's kind of like a get the money. Let me just say something. Let me just restate this for you, okay? Because it reminds me of a story back in the 1999s with a company called, I can bring it up. Hold on a second. Let me think. MicroStrategy. Remember those guys?
Yeah.
Oh, that was fun. And what they did was a little bit different here, but what they did was they basically had two components of their product, and it was a technology where they would use it for automation and for helping understand buying habits and directionalizing where people would be pushed through a bit of a, I guess it was like a mouse maze to get to the way they wanted, and to understand that and to really work your a company's best to put things in the right place. Anyway. They were doing a lot more than that, and this guy, Saylor, I believe his name was doing an awful good job. He was just like, oh, man, this is just the best company in the world. Their numbers are fabulous. They had two components. They made a sale of the product, and they had 5 years' worth of service, and they booked both up front.
Right.
So what happened was that you saw these unbelievable sales, and you saw this, you know, that was really like this jaw-dropping sales that you got to be terribly envious of. And this is a great company. At the same time, realized that this guy, Michael Saylor, was saying and was directing everybody to book the 5 years worth of services in up front when it should have been really amortized over those 5 year period. So let me just kind of, and needless to say, the stock did not do very well from there. Although it came back a long way since that time, but it was pretty ugly. But, So are you saying to me that what's happening with CRM, not saying it's fraudulent or whatever, but what you're saying to me is that they're taking their revenues and they're booking them, but taking their expenses and not booking them up front, but amortizing them over time?
They amortize both, but they're amortizing the expenses over a longer period of time. So if you have a one-year contract that somebody signs, they're going to book that almost like a magazine where they, let's just say it's $100 a month. So they're going to book a $1,200 sale or a $1,200 contract.
Right.
Then they'll recognize that $100 a month over the 12 months.
Right.
The software and the R&D, they'll capitalize and they'll run that off over 3 years.
Well, how is that going to work? That can't work forever.
It doesn't work once you...
you hit a wall.
You hit a wall because what tends to happen, and especially to do with sales commissions, is you... In order to get the sales to keep growing, you have to cut prices.
Right.
And now you have a situation of, let's say instead of $100, you're charging $50. But you're amortizing costs that were based on the $100 over the new lower revenue number. So it squeezes your margin.
Right. So the further you go out, the worse it gets.
Right.
Oh, let's see how that plays out.
The faster you grow, the more. And it's a situation of the cash is there because you're collecting it up front. So they have reasonable cash flow at times. But the earnings are what... you know, turn on a dime and suddenly start to erode and get a lot worse.
If in fact we see a competitor come out and there's a little bit of a move to another competitor, these guys could be in deep caca.
Well, and their competitor is Oracle. For the longest time, the bulls loved CRM because they always said Oracle will buy them. And with the stock at 100 times future earnings and that type of thing, Oracle just decided to build their own. And Oracle has been taking share from them in a huge way on all the selling software that they do.
Does Oracle have a CRM that's, you know, Salesforce also has it down to like one or two people you can use it, you know? Does Oracle have that, or they're just doing it for the big companies? I haven't seen that from Oracle at all.
To my knowledge, they do it primarily for the larger companies.
Right.
But
okay.
I don't know. I don't know how much they compete on every different contract. But
that's interesting.
The problem with CRM is they do get the CRM is also very promotional.
Right.
You know, if you pull up their news of the day, they're given a presentation somewhere every day.
They're unbelievable with that, by the way. Their marketing is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it
and
really
they're also
is.
Selling stock as fast as they can print it.
Right.
You know, when we first look at this one, just going through the list of SEC filings to get to the just to find the 10Q,
mm-hmm.
and the 10Q might be 2 weeks old.
Yeah.
It'd be on page 9 because it was covered. Everything on from pages 1 through 8 was insiders
selling
stock.
Wow. So let me ask you this, and then we're going to talk about the Vice Fund. Looking at this list, this is the most recent list. If you were to have to pick one, if I was going to twist your arm and say, I want one on this list, and trying to keep emotions out of it, because we always kind of get those names that kind of, you know, resonate over time. Who are you picking as the worst? This is just the bomb of all bomb diggities, the worst of companies off of the short-term warning list.
It's let's see. It's had a rebound a little bit here. I'd probably say First Solar.
Yeah, First Solar is interesting that you mentioned that. Yeah, because it's been traded First Solar.
The one.
Yeah.
And the other one that would be that could have a short-term impact here would be Weingarten Realty, which is a strip mall REIT. They run a lot of the malls that have like a grocery store that anchors them, and then a Starbucks and a Blockbuster type of thing.
And then all those other places that are empty, right?
Yep, and it depended on a lot of mom and pop restaurants and nail salons, that type of thing.
Versus a Simon that usually doesn't do that kind of deal where they have a lot of anchors, right?
Well, Simon gets the has 4 or 5 anchors, and then all the individual stores. It's the same model. Both REITs have the same basic model. The anchor gets a real discount on rent, and everyone else pays pays the difference. What's unique about Weingarten is that they have a cross default claim, but tenants that are paying higher rent mm-hmm. are doing it because there's a Starbucks there or there's a Blockbuster there, and those generate lots of volume and traffic for the mall itself.
Right.
And so as Blockbuster threatens to file bankruptcy again and continues to close stores, a lot of these guys have leases that say if the Blockbuster's not here, my rent goes from $20 a foot to $16.
Oh, nice.
And so you can have a lot of these strip malls to suddenly get all the rents redone at a lower rate just based on that. Plus, you have a number of retailers and restaurants nationwide that are basically spending a lot of 2009, a lot of 2010, making rent concessions one of their big source of cost savings. So they're going back to their landlords and saying, find a way to cut our prices because the stuff we signed in 2007 and 2008 is too much and we're not making it.
Right.
So you're seeing rent pressure there, and then the occupancies is just the mom and pop stuff goes down is still going to be a problem. They wrote off a lot of the properties they had under development in 2008, but they did not write down anything that they bought in 2006, 2007, which to me is sort of the inflated values. And so I think you should still see an asset write down there because the cash flows are obviously under pressure in terms of supporting the carrying values they have on it. And as they go to roll over debt, they're having to pay more for the debt. So let's say they were paying 5%, now they're paying 8%. So that's going to shrink the cash flow that goes to the shareholder. Lower rent is going to shrink cash flow that goes to the shareholder. Lower occupancy is going to shrink the cash flow that goes to the shareholder.
Yeah, but then the government's going to what they'll do, just like they did with the and this is the big problem is handicapping what the government's going to do. Let's be honest, okay? Because let's look what happened recently to the home builders. I mean, I just saw a piece. Matter of fact, my friend Frank Curzio wrote an amazing piece on looking at I don't even know what the number is. It was some unbelievable number, $30-40 billion worth of benefit to the big home builders that got to go back and scoop up tax losses from 2004 to 2008 and use it now. In other words, they were allowed to go backwards and use this stuff for now that they were disallowed back then.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, this stuff looks good.
Well, the problem a REIT has is that it already is tax-free.
Right.
So government giving tax incentives or something along those, any kind of tax incentive or change in the tax law won't affect them. All they could really do is say, in order to be a REIT, you have to pay out 95% of your or 90% of your income is passed. It has to go through, passed through to shareholders. That keeps it a tax-free entity. They could lower that and say maybe you only have to pass through 40%, and that would certainly help a REIT pay down debt because they could apply more of the cash flow to debt reduction. But either the second they come out and cut their dividend in half, the stock's going to get chopped too.
Right,
so.
Right. Just a reminder, we're talking with Jeff Middlesworth, and he's actually, he writes the BehindTheNumbers.com. He's also, which we're going to talk about very quickly, the whole idea of the Vice Fund, which is for all those people out there that don't really care so much about only investing in green stuff and things that are good for you. Jeff runs a fund, a mutual fund called the Vice Fund, which we're dealing with what? We're dealing with liquor as much as you can buy and drink, and tobacco and firearms and everything nasty, huh, buddy?
Pretty much, and gambling as well.
So do you have to do a lot of research, like on site? Because I could be, I could go with you. If you need somebody to go with you, I can go.
We definitely have a surplus of people willing to investigate these things.
Right. I mean, who wants to go to the you know, the sugar-free, you know, good-for-you nutrition conference when we can be heading on off to Vegas and checking out the guns, firearms, chewing tobacco, and Rick's nightclub cabaret? You got Rick's in there, right?
We don't have Rick's at this point. But
why not?
Well, part of our deal, one of the things that really makes this this theory work is companies with high barriers to entry.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, they have pricing power, they generate lots of cash flow, and that rewards shareholders with dividends and share repurchases. So at this point, you know, strip bars and you know, internet porn and that type of thing, it doesn't really have the high barrier to entry at the moment, but we're looking for ways to play it a little more in some manner to get a few of those names in there.
Right. So what kind of names do you have? Give me just some, just generally, you know, nothing, just, you know, what do we, give me sectors or what, you know, things that you're
looking at. Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, tobacco, we're looking to have as much as possible a kind of an equal share of tobacco, which are the big names, Philip Morris, Altria, Laura Lard, alcohol, which is, you know, Budweiser, Anheuser-Busch, that's Diageo,
right,
which owns a lot of the spirits, gambling, which is, you know, IGT, Bally Technology, which makes slot machines.
Which have not been doing well, let's be honest. Those companies are not doing well.
Oh, no, but at the same point, they're cheaper than a lot of the standard casinos.
Right.
A lot of the casino, I mean, the casino stocks have gone straight up through all of 2009. And you know, at the end of 2008, it was a question of, well, will some of these actually survive? And now the question, the answer seems to be, oh yeah, they'll be here forever. You know, they're fine again. But they basically need 2007 to happen times two to justify some of the valuations that they're trading for.
And Macau, we need another Macau too. Don't forget. Another Singapore. True. Let me ask you something about the. I just want to stop you here because there's something that really interests me about the casino area. It appears to me, and I don't think there's any question about this, that states are having a real hard time right now. But whether it's tax collections are problematic, whether it's because you know, they have to pay on this debt that they don't have coming. I mean, there's 100 different reasons why they have problems, okay? And it would seem to me that all these states that all the years didn't want to have gambling, it would seem to say, hey, you know what? This looks like a really good opportunity. You know, we have whether they do it through you know, kind of the Indian situation and the you know, through that, or they do it themselves. Do you see that, number one, as something that really would potentially occur? And number two, it would seem to me that companies like an IGT, a WMS, a Bally's, when they start with just using the not the table games for a moment, so you have the Shuffle Masters and the other ones for that, but, you know, looking at the lottery style slash, which is scientific gaming, right?
Scientific gaming.
And you look at, you know, I'm looking for the word here. I can't get it here. The when you pull the arm, what's my problem? The slot machines. I don't know what the heck. I'm sorry. I don't know where I was with that. But the slot machines, those companies, do you think that would be a first kind of, you know, a first time benefit to these guys, and there could be some real upside here?
I think you will see gaming spread, because as you see, a lot of states are quickly saying, hey, we can help cure budget problems. We can keep the money in our state versus having it go across the river to the neighboring state. That's a big issue. And you know, that would certainly help the machine makers. They should also be helped by the fact that all the casinos with their debt problem have not updated their machines in several years. Normally, that's about it's almost like the Microsoft story and Dell,
right.
Where everybody hated Windows Vista, so you had this huge slowdown in computer purchases. because people didn't want to have Vista, and they were waiting for Windows 7 to come out, and now there's supposed to be this big surge of replacement demand.
Right.
Well, you have a similar situation with casinos and slot machines and video poker machines, where normally if they replace them on a 4 or 5 year cycle, they're about 7 years now. And so it's been delayed for a while, but you have a fairly big pent-up demand that should be coming along to help out the machine makers.
And that's the IGTs, International Game Technology. Do you like WMS?
I like Bally's more, BYI.
Yep.
Very clean balance sheet. And
But they also own casinos, though.
No, that
they don't have. That's not.
This is a spinoff of
But isn't there some? But they don't have any kind of. They don't have any ownership at all now.
Bally's Casino, if I remember correctly, was part of Park Place.
Right,
casinos,
and
that went private. I think it was part of.
Maybe that's what it was. Yeah, I thought they still had a little bit of a piece of this, but maybe they do in a different way. But so, the Bally's machines here. Could see benefits. The IGT clearly could see benefits. And what about, there was another, who was the other gaming one? Who was the other competition in there? They only made, remember they had the ones that were the level 3, you know, where you'd bet against each other for the big jackpots? I'll look it up.
Right. Oh, it's there is one just called Jackpots.
Yeah, but I'm thinking.
It's tinier. IGT does the mega quarters and the jackpot stuff where, you see a bank of machines, and it's got the $10 million sign. It's always rolling up by a quarter.
Right. Here it is. The one I'm thinking of is Multimedia Gaming. MGAM. Okay. You know that one at all?
I don't follow that one as much.
Yeah, that one has a similar thing. Okay. So, all right, so we got all that. And essentially, you know, who is this geared to? I mean, this is geared to somebody who says, you know what, I just want some investments that make money, and it really, it's more of a little bit of a specialty item, though. I mean, honestly, you know, kind of you're leaving out some of the things that maybe are, I mean, who wouldn't you have in there? I mean, you wouldn't have a Jamba Juice? Probably not.
Oh, no, yeah. For me, the way I always try to explain it is that you end up with a situation of if you went and screened for stocks and said, what's your ideal stock? And if it was, okay, I want high cash flow generation, I want to see growing pricing, I want something that you know can show me a multi-decade record of posting strong results, a company that doesn't need to use a lot of cash flow for to stay in business. They don't have a lot of R&D. They don't have a ton of advertising. They don't have a ton of capital spending that has to constantly recur. If you ran, so this company's going to basically reward shareholders with repurchases over time. It's going to grow with some acquisitions that are fairly cheap, and it's going to pay a lot of dividends. And if you ran that as a screen, these are the stocks that you'd pull up. And the reason that a lot of them are cheap, especially the tobacco and things of that nature and the defense contractors, is that people look at it and say, oh, well, even though that's the ideal stock I want, I don't want to own a tobacco company or I don't want to own a defense company. And so you end up with these companies that are trading with, you know, at 7 times cash flow or 5 times cash flow, and they yield, you know, twice and 3 times what the market does. And all the studies have always shown that companies that pay dividends dividends are basically about half the stock market return. Anytime you hear the people tout that the long-term stock market return is 9% or 10%, usually half that return comes from dividends. So in a lot of cases, these are companies that are paying higher dividends than the S&P as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets us a lot of return right there. And then on top of that, you're going to get some growth as the industry consolidates. You're going to have pricing power that's going to continue to drive cash flows, and they can buy back shares, which should drive earnings per share and raise the stock. So these tend to be just sort of steady growers, over many, many years. It's products that people use regardless of the economic times, and it's something that they get some growth out of emerging markets in a lot of cases. And for us, it's companies that really reward shareholders and have. And they have business models that make sense.
Right, and a little bit of evil in them, let's be honest. A little bit more fun than the usual that may be out there. But we're going to we're gonna have to cut it there because we're running a little bit over. I want to thank you. This is Jeff Middlesworth, and he is the manager of the Vice Fund, which you'll be able to find. Just type in the Vice Fund. We'll put a link also on the website in the show notes. Also, He is he writes for the Behind the Numbers, which is names of companies and companies that are on potential watch lists that you should be looking at. He gives a great summary and education of why these companies are on that, and you know, continually updates them to make sense of some of the things that are you know, some things that maybe don't make any sense to us on the surface, but looking a little bit deeper inside of them to see kind of what really are the numbers and what's really involved here and what's the outlook, instead of trying to put that, you know, constantly trying to sugarcoat everything. So I want to thank you very much for joining me today, and I encourage my listeners to check out the offerings they have, because good stuff here. In the meantime, I want to thank you for joining me on this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 153. Please make sure, as in closing, to go over to the show notes. Please make sure to donate to the Jason Taylor Foundation, his Reading to Succeed program. Make a lot of sense to help a lot of kids that need some help, an at-risk child. Make sure to check out all the things that we had mentioned there today, the Vice Fund and all these good things. And I thank you for listening. Next week, we're going to have on a gentleman who has been asked for by many times. His name is Mr. Malden. I'm trying to think of his first name, and I'm having a problem here. Oh, we'll announce it next week. I can't remember his first name. Malden. Anyway, he's been asked for by a lot of people. We're going to have him on. And the mystery guest for next week, that's what we're going to say. Okay? And the bottom line is that, you know, you have a safe week, an interesting week coming up. I think we're getting a little bit heady in these markets, a little bit frothy. These are the kind of names that you want to check out that Jeff brought to us together today. And again, we'll post all that on the website. Until next time, thanks for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you soon. Have a profitable week. Have a safe week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.